As we go marching, marching.
In 1999, Quebec nurses went on strike, but after 22 days, their action was declared illegal. 10 years before, women faced even worse legal maneuvering, when striking nurses lost 1 year of seniority for every day of the illegal strike. Just last fall, 80,000 teachers throughout Quebec walked out, and again, essential services laws were cited and teachers forced back to work.
In North America, the Industrial Revolution came through women workers.
Over the next 4 weeks, we'll take up these issues here on CKUT's Long-Term Memory Radio Project, Women's Labor History in Quebec and Canada, every Wednesday from 5 to 6 p.m., concluding on May Day.
Women have always been essential to the labor movement. First unions that were formed by male-skilled workers who weren't admitting those women.
Hearts starve as well as bodies. Give us bread, but give us roll.
The history of women and unionization in Quebec is complex, like the relationship women have with work. I met Lillian Robinson, the principal of the Simone de Beauvoir Institute here in Montreal, to talk about it. I asked her to tell us about the first woman organizing experiences.
In North America, the Industrial Revolution came through women workers. It was mostly in New England, but much of it just over the border in Vermont and Massachusetts. There were the first American factories. And the owners of these factories, those capitalists, certainly wanted to make a big profit, but they also wanted to avoid what they saw as the worst excesses of the Industrial Revolution as it came to England. They saw these were puritanical men. They saw them as moral excesses, that the kind of excessive overwork, the resort to alcohol, the child labor, were all factors that they saw as morally degenerating to the workers. They didn't think of what it did to the souls of the capitalists. But therefore, they hired young women off the farms who were brought to Lowell, Massachusetts, and eventually to a number of other places as well, to live in supervised boarding houses. They were required to go to church twice a week. It was sort of like a dormitory. These were girls who had either worked on their family farms or who had taught school part of the year. You didn't have to have a degree in those days to teach school. But school also in rural areas did not last very much of the year because the children were also needed for farm labor, so that these girls could earn more money coming to Lowell, and the families had no concern about sending them because they would be helping the family economy. Many of them sent their brothers to university, particularly to become ministers. This was the culture in which they participated in the economic life of their families by helping out. And the families did not have the slightest concern about their moral well-being because they were being taken care of by these good Christian gentlemen. They were also well paid because there was no sense yet about exactly how much labor you could extract. They had to supervise new kinds of machinery. As time went on, they did what was not yet called the speed up. More machines being supervised by a girl at a time for the same money, or they would lower the money. That was when the first organization started. But they were not what you and I would call labor unions yet. They were organizations of the working girls. They had magazines. Some of them were connected with the first movement they had, which was the movement to fight for a 10-hour day. If we think of it, you know, the 8-hour day is not easy. The 10-hour day, and that was a dream. But they had a dream for something more than that. They wanted to have more control over their work lives and their personal lives in a situation where they saw those as connected. The manufacturers also sponsored some of their magazines where they were forbidden to write about labor conditions, but they wrote about everything else. And so we have, for those people, historically, a much better sense of who they were, what their minds were like, how they felt about their lives as they became the first generation of North American workers. By the time that conditions were much worse in the mills, the manufacturers were hiring and, in fact, recruiting immigrants from Europe, and in Quebec, immigrants off the farms who were not being treated as sort of living in dormitories and being supervised and so on. In fact, I saw a parallel around the early part of this century. We're moving up, you know, nearly 100 years by now. But in the early part of this century, I saw a parallel to the research I've done about Thailand, where in order to help her family, a girl's choice, if you want to call it a choice, is between working in the sweatshops, making athletic shoes or toys, or working in the sex industry. And she can be self-supporting if she works in a sweatshop. She can send money home if she works in the sex industry. But I saw the parallel between that and what happened here in Montreal less than 100 years ago, when the girls would come in off the farms, the peasant girls in Thailand, come in off the train, and they'd be met at the railroad station by pimps who would offer them a much better sounding job with more money and glamour. I don't know how many of them were tricked into the sex industry and how many of them were attracted to the sex industry because of the conditions that they were going to be meeting in the industrial world. In any case, women's labor history starts with women working and organizing informally, making demands. The American workers, they were working on cotton that was grown by slaves. So before the Civil War in the United States, the working women, who we would now call wage slaves, were organizing against slavery because they didn't want to have to be part of that process. But before that, the time when they were first recruiting young women off the farms in the States was actually the 1820s, when the very first, when the Industrial Revolution came 50 years after England to North America. From the 1850s on, and particularly after the Civil War in the United States, conditions got much, much worse, much more expected for the same kind of wage, extraordinarily long hours, more child labor, and the importation in a lot of these industries of European immigrants, many times intending that in the same shop there would be people who couldn't organize because they couldn't even speak to each other. And this was always understood as something that unmarried women did. And the married woman, on the other hand, it wasn't that she didn't work. Not only was domestic work to keep the working class family going extremely difficult, but the married woman might very well be doing piecework at home. In the film about the life of Léa Roback, Une lumière dans le clan noisseur, she talks about how the girls in the garment factories, and this is well into the 20th century, would, if they let the foreman or the factory owner in a small place, take some sexual liberties with them, then they had the privilege of taking home huge piles of work for the younger children and the grandmother to sew. That's what they got out of the sexual harassment. But there were lots of women, particularly in the garment industry, who did piecework at home. There's also a kind of work which is absolutely not subject to labor organization that the grandmothers, I imagine, of a lot of our listeners and the great-grandmothers did. They took in boarders. They helped out, that's in quotes, in the family business. Or they worked on the farm. All of those are economic activities which are essential to the survival of a family or for a single mother and her children, but are not recognized as she doesn't work. She takes in boarders. In the time of the heaviest immigration, a lot of the immigrants were men coming to North America without their families. There was no way that those guys took an apartment and cooked for themselves. They didn't know how. They couldn't afford a whole apartment. They had a room in the home of a working class family, or they shared a room in the home of a working class family, where the woman also then cooked and did their laundry. This is not even the formal thing that we mean when we say boarding house, but there were also those run by other people's grandmothers and great-grandmothers.
Hitch on them wings and go try the air. Looks like everybody in the whole wide world down on me. Down on
everybody in the whole wide world down on. Mary and Martha, Luke and John, all them prophets is dead and gone. Looks like everybody in the whole wide world down on. Down on me, down on me. Look like everybody in the whole wide world down on me. Ain't been a habit, I've been told. Streets up there's paved with gold.
Skilled workers. Even in industries where the vast majority of the workers were what were called unskilled, if you could just run a sewing machine, that was not a skill. So all the work in the garment industry, which was very big in New England, New York, and Quebec, was done by what was the work that, I mean, I consider it a skill to sew, because I'm not very good at it, but it was unskilled labor. The work of the cutters and so forth was skilled labor that was done by men. I have never heard of a woman even being permitted to do that job. And so the first unions that organized were organized according to the craft. And it was not until well into the 20th century, in the 1930s, that there was significant organizing of the whole industry. However, that's the idea of that started in the first decade of the 20th century with the IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World, which is essentially an anarchist organization, still exists, was had a lot of its energy in the West, but also worked on some of the most successful strikes in the labor history of New England, Mid-Atlantic states of the United States, and New England, and Quebec. So that I said that the owners, at a certain point when they were encouraging European immigration, I mean, they went over and told people that the streets were paved with gold. You tell that to hungry people, you know, they come, they find the streets aren't paved with gold, but there's a chance to get a job. They had people talking many different languages, and with many different ethnic customs. In Lawrence, Massachusetts, the IWW organized a strike across all the different small factories in the woolen industry, across all those languages. They had organizing going on in 57 languages. And people always talk about the role of the women in that strike. The women workers were a minority. They were the single women. But there were all the wives, and we say at home. The IWW at that strike invented, essentially, the mass picket, which seems to us completely logical. You're not just going to have a few people picketing, you're going to have everybody out there. That's where they started it. Fallait y penser. Somebody had to think of it first. And, of course, then over the years, the governments and the, you know, have put restraints on how much picketing you can do and under what conditions. But at that point, what they did with their pickets and their parades and their music and their cultural life, as well as their food, for the, you know, was they got the women out of the home, the women across all these ethnic lines, and the children participated. They sent the children to good socialist families all over the place so that they wouldn't be in danger and they would be able to eat. And that created sympathy. But there were children who were workers who were also part of the demonstrations. And the traditional labor history of this is that the women otherwise would have been, and often were, in European and American situations, North American situations, a reactionary force. Because the women, woman is at home trying to say, how am I going to find a potato to put in this pot to feed, you know, to turn it into soup to feed the family? And why are you going out on strike? Why are you persisting there? You know, a little bit is better than nothing, etc. That's the traditional image that they say the IWW broke down by bringing, recognizing that the wife of the worker is a member of the working class. More recently, feminist labor historians have demonstrated that in that case, and I bet we can find it in all the other cases too, across the ethnic lines, the women already had networks, and that it was the women at home who were part of the backbone of the strike, rather than being brought along by some movement that understands better than they do. But the thing was, it wasn't just going along, it was making use of relationships that they had already created in the community, that the a working class community is an organic unit. It's the home and the neighborhood and the shop. And that's what later on in the sit-down strikes of the 1930s, the men, and this was happened in Europe too, they were called factory occupations there, and that's where the Americans learned about it. But the sit-down strikes, they took over the plant. Now, once you've taken over the plant, the very first one is not talked about very much because they took over the cafeteria too. Everywhere else, they had to get supplies brought in. Somebody had to be picketing, and if the men are inside, who's picketing on the outside, and who's bringing in the supplies, who's feeding them? It was the women. They were called the ladies auxiliary, which makes them sound like the good lady, you know, the ladies of the church who were making, you know, things for the church supper. They were the backbone of creating, and those were industrial unions that did use the skilled and the unskilled workers in the same union. So, yes, women have been slow to unionize, but women have always been essential to the labor movement. The first unions that were formed by male skilled workers who weren't admitting those women. So one of the first big strikes in the 20th century in the United States was the women shirtwaist makers, the blouses. And those blouses by this time were the uniform being worn by the women office workers. So there was, it was tremendously mass-produced. The office workers didn't earn very much. They had to have these nice blouses to wear, cotton blouses. The shirtwaist makers worked for small sweatshops. They were subcontractors, their sweatshops. And they went out on strike in 1909 and 1910. We covered months. And they were mostly teenage girls, daughters of immigrants, many of them immigrants themselves, Jewish and Italian girls who held those lines. And it took a great deal to get them into the union because it was understood up to that time it was a male-dominated union run by the skilled workers. The men did support this, but it took a lot of doing, and it was partly the challenge of seeing 16-year-old girls who said, we're prepared to go out on strike. And particularly working in the small shops and all the shops at once having to go out, the coordination, the secrecy up until a certain moment, etc. They lost that strike, but they won, you know, the union. A lot of the key organizers were blacklisted, which is not just that you lose one job, because there were jobs all over the place, but if you're blacklisted by the manufacturers, then you can't get a job in your city at all, even if your city is the size of New York, which is where the strike was.
Gray are touched with all the radiance that a sudden sun discloses. Oh,
for the people hear us singing, bread and roses, bread and roses. As we go marching, marching, we battle too for men, for they are women's children, and we mother them again. Our life shall not be sweated from birth until life closes. Hearts starve as well as bodies. Give us bread, but give us roses. As we go marching, marching, unnumbered women dead go crying through our singing their ancient call for bread. Small art and love and beauty, their drudging spirits new. Yes, it is bread we fight for, but we fight for roses too. As we go marching, marching, we bring the greater days. The rising of the women means the rising of the race. No more the drudge and idler tend that toil where one reposes, but a sharing of life's glories, bread and roses. Bread.
Welcome back. You're listening to a conversation with Lillian Robinson. Now that Lillian Robinson explained how the women first organized and later unionized, we will see how their demands as their union member were influenced by their experience as wife and mother.
In Quebec, there are a number of organizations, feminist organizations, that aren't even only oriented towards labor issues, that have used the slogan, bread and roses. And that slogan came from working women, union women, marching in that strike that I mentioned before in Lawrence, Massachusetts, in the woolen industry. They had signs that said, give us bread and roses too. That meant, and that's why Ralph Chaplin made a poem that he set to music that is still sung as a kind of anthem of the North American women's movement, Bread and Roses, that when women talk, one of the lines in the song is, hearts starve as well as bodies. Give us bread, but give us roses. And another line in that song is, the rising of the women is the rising of the race, meaning the human race. Now, people are so sensitive about being accused of racism that they change the words so that it rhymes with something different. And now, the rising of the women is the rising of us all. And either way, it's saying two things. That women, when they have organized in unions, whether they are the woman's voice within a mixed union or a predominantly female union, often are talking about quality of life issues, talking about child care, talking about the relation of the union to other kinds of family and community concerns around schools, safety in the streets, education in the sense of the union scholarships that exist in certain places, thinking about the future of the working class in terms of our children in different ways. I don't mean that men don't think about these things, but women who work, who are unionized, do still have a double job. More of the housework, more of the child care, more of the attention to the future of the children is in their hands. And if there's a single parent, more often than not, that parent is a woman. So it's not just the family that we're talking about here. In fact, the concern for quality of life issues. The other thing about the problems that are specific to predominantly female unions is that in the United States, the issue is around public employees, that there are many prohibitions in different states against people who work for the state being permitted to unionize, or if they are permitted to unionize, being permitted to strike, which is, after all, the weapon of working people. Withdraw your labor. So that teachers, who are predominantly women at the high school and below levels, are often forbidden to strike. Nurses in the United States are much less likely to be unionized. Here in Quebec, they have gotten around this question about public and private employees by the law that talks about essential services and how you're not permitted to strike essential services that are life and death to the community. To the extent that women work in those services, and you look at nurses and teachers, that's who they are, in very large numbers, you have special problems that also have to do with women internalizing that. We're told that those professions are often represented as being extensions of women's nature. You know, we work with children, we work with the sick, and women have done that long before we were paid for it. There's a certain implication we're lucky to get paid at all. In the British newspaper, The Guardian, last week, there were parodies of the way people talk to teachers and about how it's a true vocation, and that how if you said that to people who do something else, say, thank you, how marvelous you are, instead of giving the money, you know, for what, you know, what they earn, then you know, it would just be nonsense. You bank employees, that's a true vocation, right? So you don't have to, you're terrific, you're taking care of my account very nicely, thank you. But people who work in the nonprofit sector, which was what this is about, who do give of themselves, internalize to some extent the idea that it's an extension of their natures, that they are essential, which they are, but since the state the law recognizes they're essential only in one sense, but not in the other sense, that they have to be therefore properly rewarded. Particularly with teachers, there is a sense that teachers have a privilege because they have a longer vacation than other working people. The notion that it can be quantified into those hours and that it counts as part-time labor because it's a few hours short of what full-time labor counts as, when teachers give so much of their time that is uncompensated by its nature, and that the planning process, the time that is supposed to be leisure time, is absolutely not that for a good teacher particularly, but that they all have to take time that is not officially, if they punched in and punched out, it still wouldn't be counted. And nobody recognizes that. Only teachers, whether it's university teachers or in a different, very different way, the teachers that are predominantly women in the high schools and the elementary schools, get this challenge that they somehow have an easier job than anybody else. And nobody thinks nurses have an easy job.
However, they're still underpaid.
Absolutely, because they're essential services, because they're women, because they do have a sense of vocation as healers, but that doesn't mean that you're supposed to exploit the sense of vocation. Do we want nurses who don't have a heart? Do we want people who only think of it as something that they're going to do within exactly the terms that they're hired for? Then we're going to have a much worse kind of health situation. Everybody at some time or another needs the services of a nurse. And if you go into a hospital, you are going to face the conditions that the nurses are facing. You are going to be, and that means that all of us have a real vested interest in that one, including, you would think, the people who make the laws.
Work together if they'd show some true respect for me. at number three. Changed the bed in Anne's room. God, that woman's been a gift to me. What she knows of dying and the courage that she showed. All I've done to help her has been given back a hundredfold. I worry that the old man, he's due to be released. I figure without help he'll soon be back on the street. So damn the politicians for the fools that they are. When they're old and sick and dying, let them live on mistletoe caviar.
Started out, nobody wanted that system about pay equity anyway. It doesn't meet anybody's highest needs. But the problem is that people always used to say that the only feminist demand they favored very often was equal pay for equal work. But how do you judge equal work across different job categories in a labor market that is so gendered, so segmented by gender? So we came out with this other one, which was comparable worth. And for a long time, that was a buzzword that was very important. But again, how do you compare comparable worth? What it tends to do, unfortunately, is to put down the jobs of men that are, make it sound as if we don't have respect for the men who do those jobs, rather than saying, no, we want equal respect. We want to pull everybody up. We don't want to put anybody down. Because on the one hand, there are the services that are deemed essential, where they are unionized, but it's not just unionizing, but being able to struggle effectively. And if they take the principal weapon out of our hands or make it hard to use, then being unionized is not, it clearly is only the first step. But for the other services that nobody would call essential, although, you know, we certainly need them, they're those things that people call pink-collar jobs, the hairdressers, the waitresses, the domestic workers, the hospital workers who are not directly health workers, the hotel workers, all those jobs are service industries where it, in many cases, a lot of the workers are in small workplaces where the connection with the supervisor is different, where even the connection with the boss sometimes or the owner, it is very difficult to organize when your body of people is that spread out. And also, again, those are industries in which there's a great deal of casual, temporary help, part-time help. People need the union the most because they don't get the benefits, they don't get the seniority. They don't get the privileges that we think of as belonging to having a regular job. But for that very reason, they're more vulnerable, and it's harder to get people to put themselves into jeopardy. Well, they're not stupid. They don't. If it can't guarantee them a better life, and it could put the job, however bad it is, into danger, women are going to think twice and then think a third time before they unionize. And there are so many, many women's jobs like that. If you think you walk through your day with your eyes open, starting your day, putting on your clothing and looking at the label, and then walk through and see how many women you see doing jobs in which, think about what it would be like for them to be unionized. Yes, once they're unionized, their life could be better. But how hard it would be for that step to be taken and for unions to meet their needs in those circumstances. How many people you see a day doing those jobs, the dimensions of the problem become apparent. And then, of course, there's office workers. That's service work also. It's skilled work. It's very rare in North America for office workers to be organized. And when they are, they're very often not organized in traditional labor unions. There have been, since the 70s, various office worker organizations that have a feminist content to them that do not have an affiliation with a labor union, or sometimes come to that rather late. There was an organization called 9to5, for instance, which when it unionized became Local 925, because in order to keep that that consciousness. But that's part of that problem again is many people in small offices, many people in conditions where it feels dangerous. Also, problems about the consciousness that you're a white collar worker. In Europe, secretaries are organized, clerical workers are organized, computer workers are organized. And it's in the same union. In France, there's something called the Syndicat du Livre, which is everybody from the editor who's involved in making a book, from the editors to the salespeople to the printers to etc., organized according to industry, and that includes a great many white collar workers who do things with paper, in one way or another. In North America, that is not the custom, but as they start sending more clerical jobs out of the country, and the way they can do that is for data entry. Much of it is already being done in the Caribbean islands, for instance, at one quarter the wage that somebody would make here. Those women are under poor conditions, and it's taking jobs here, from here, from Canada, from the United States, and from England at the moment because of the English language. It can happen with other languages too, of course. And that is one of the many places that there is an impetus. But white-collar workers tend to identify upward with their boss rather than downward with other kinds of workers. As the conditions change, that's going to have to change also.
So why are you not organizing? It's from a lack of consciousness?
Well, I hate to call other people unconscious. You know, I mean, they have their consciousness, which is different. They are being fed. It's a dual consciousness. They know they're workers on the one hand, but they do have a kind of a personalized, in many cases, personalized relationship with a supervisor or a boss, and the boss isn't the owner, and so on. So that, and they also, they're doing very often women's kinds of things like making coffee being the buffer between the man and the world, representing him, lying for him very often about how busy he is, mothering him in some sense. But of course there are many, many jobs where there isn't that directorate, that are clerical jobs where you're not a secretary at all, where you're in what look like industrialized conditions, in fact, working on something like data entry, where there is a supervisor you don't even see who is able to snoop into your machine and see how many keystrokes a minute, an hour, you're making, and let you know when you're not making enough, that kind of thing. What is the difference between that job and working in production in a factory? only the culture, what the culture can make you believe, is the difference between me and you and a factory worker. But there is that sense that you have possibilities, that you are part of the, in a sense, the administration of business, and therefore not quite management or anything like that, but you're in the not the part that makes anything either. And as we have fewer and fewer industries that make anything, and more industries that make only paper, and you know, or exist in the cyber world, we have more people who are the proletariat, but who are represented in the culture as not being that, and that's hard to get through. And as I say, they're also at the same time many of them fulfilling women's roles within the workplace, within the work family.
My strong right arm built the ship that sailed to war. My strong right arm built the ship, and what was that all for?
In 1941, the war had just begun. Jim was so young, but soon was off to hold a gun. I was 19, our child was only 3, when the papers said the shipyards needed me. I moved to Bremerton in 1942. I learned to weld, I was the best one on our crew. The work was hard, the heat would burn my lungs all day. But when the paycheck came, we girls would feel okay. In 1943, in August, 8 a.m., I'd not been sleeping well, my mind was full of Jim. There was a knock, a man in uniform stood there. He said my Jim was dead. I hadn't seen him in 2 years. In 1945, the war came to an end, and on that very day, the big boss, he came in. He smiled and said, "My girls, the boys are coming home. You've earned a rest. Go home. Your work here now is done." Picked up a scrap of metal, and I carved my name full bore, so my child would know I was a welder in the war. No place to go, I was a widow with a child. So I waitressed, and I cooked, and I married in a while. Sometimes I see that scrap with my name carved in so deep, and I recall the day the boss told me to leave, how I felt like some old rag they tossed aside, as useless as my patriotic pride.
My strong right arm built the ship that sailed to war. My strong right arm built the ship, and what was that all for?
You're listening to a conversation with Dr. Lillian Robinson, who is the principal of the Simone de Beauvoir Institute here in Montreal. And we're having a conversation on the experience of women within the union movement in North America, and especially in Quebec. I asked Dr. Lillian Robinson to tell us about the different impact that the World War I and II had on the experience of women within the workforce.
When the labor movement started to be successful here, they moved it to the southern United States on the assumption that not only was there no labor militancy tradition, but that they could never develop one because they thought that black and white could not ever come together. And it took 3 generations of effort to unionize. The film Norma Rae, that came out in the late 1970s, is based on a true story about the last industries in the American South that unionized, and about one organizer. And it's very, you see in there, there's a moment at which Sally Field, who plays the Norma Rae, the organizer, she's about to be taken out of the shop by the guards, but she stands up on a table and so noisy that she can't say anything. She's carrying a sign that says Union. And then they lead her out. And the first hand that goes to shut off a machine is her own mother, who has been made deaf by the noise of the shop. And then all that you see first is all the black hands turning off their machines, because the black women understand the need for solidarity, and then the white. And that's as much as the union, the movie says about how the final stage of the organizing of those runaway shops was possible because it was possible finally to get black and white together. In the First World War, in Canada, the United States, and England, women engaged in war production and also went out onto the land because, again, men were taken from the farms and food had to be produced for the war effort as well as other kinds of goods. The reward for that in both Canada and England was the vote. And there was enough of a depression right after the war that the jobs were simply not available, and many of them at that time were not union jobs in any case, particularly, of course, the land jobs, but the other ones too. And then, of course, in the 1930s, although my sense is that for working people, it was not the stock market crash that created the depression, but conditions before that, that in the 1920s, there was already a depression for working people, and that it was noticed once Wall Street crashed, and then it got worse, of course. But in the depression, there were even, in the United States, for instance, if two members of a couple, a heterosexual couple, worked for the federal government, one of them was forced to quit. And usually it was the man who had the better-paying job, so the woman would quit. Now, you wouldn't think there were that many women government workers who were married to male government workers, except in Washington, D.C., and places like that. But there were the postal service all over the country, you know. And a lot of women, you know, had those jobs. Those were the women, among others, who went into the workforce. Again, we're talking Canada, England, and the United States had very similar situations as far as that went. Women in enormous numbers going into the labor force. In England, they were essentially drafted, unmarried women, into doing some kind of work for the war effort, whether that was officially militarized or not. In Canada and the United States, it was a voluntary effort. The United States, they did all sorts of advertising to recruit women. I mean, first of all, there were women who were able to earn more money than they had ever dreamed of at what had been defined as men's jobs and weren't even available to men in the Depression. But women who had been domestic workers, boy, you get out of that other woman's kitchen and into an airplane factory. Women who had been clerical workers, women who had not been able to find work at all after they finished their education, were very little, you know, and women who had been housewives before. And I've seen a propaganda film that was made that was addressed to women saying, if you can follow a pattern to cut out a dress, then you can cut out an airplane wing. Now, they didn't get exactly the job where you snip, 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 then they have an airplane wing. And then television, when television came in the post-war period, was always the father went out to work at some unspecified job very often, unless he worked in the entertainment industry, like in I Love Lucy, you know, but otherwise he went out to work and he wore a suit and a tie to go do his job, and she stayed at home and took care of the emotional needs of the family. You never saw her laboring in the home. She would often wear, you know, a dress with stockings and high-heeled shoes. You couldn't do, you scrub your toilet in that dress. But she was there for her children. She was the explainer, the counselor of her children. She was, if the man was a bumbling kind of husband, she had wisdom. If he had wisdom too, they had clearly separated roles. And the most she would do in the way of actual labor in the home was baking. Made coffee and cookies, a great deal. So this made people, I mean, it wasn't the primary thing, but it was telling people stories all the time about how the normal life was lived by people whose family arrangements and labor arrangements were that way. And in the 70s, a colleague called me one day, and she was teaching the course on the family. And she said, what is the Donna Reed Show? And I said, what is? It's been off for years. She said, okay, but you're the media person. Tell me what it said, you know. And I said, she was a doctor's wife. She was one of these mothers who was definitely at home. She would always find a good poem to read them, a piece of philosophy when her teenage children had problems. Why are you asking me? I finally got around to him. And she said, because the first day in class, they went around the room, and the students in the course on the family, and one of them said very early on, I used to hate the Donna Reed show because my mother worked, and she wasn't there for me the way Donna Reed was, and I used to hate, I hated my mother because she wasn't there. Wasn't normal like Donna Reed. And because someone mentioned it early, a number of them mentioned the same program when they went around the room, that their mother was a bad mother because she was working her fingers to the bone in some other woman's kitchen or selling things at the dollar store or working in an office. She was precisely the things that were keeping them alive and making them, helping them have a decent quality of life were the things that that the media were telling these students were made her a bad mother. Heaven forbid if you wanted to work just because you had interest and desire rather than because you were absolute economic necessity. Whereas nobody ever put that kind of pressure, of course, on men. So in those conditions, the jobs that women were going into also were not the industries that are unionized. Although at the end of World War II, in one union that covered a lot of the women workers, I believe it was the United Automobile Workers, because they were making the tanks and the trucks and that, and so forth, 80% of those women said they wanted to keep those jobs. These were the best jobs they'd ever had, and the conditions had been provided to make it possible for them to work. Nothing like 80% got to teach those jobs. There's a very good pamphlet called Separated and Unequal about what happened to the women war workers in those jobs. And in the whole post-war period, the one thing that's happened since the rise of the women's movement in the late 1960s is that we've taken another look at those figures, and those figures have increased. And the conditions have been created such that where there is a couple in the family, two incomes are necessary. This has meant more changes, I think, for the couple than it has been for the working conditions of the woman. It means that they have to work out, and in many cases they do, with under terrible conditions, work out a more just arrangement about housework and childcare than has been, than was necessary and possible before. But in terms of improving the working conditions for women, much less so far has been accomplished.
Well, a little red hen found a grain of wheat, said this looks good enough to eat, but I'll plant it instead, make me some bread, said to the other guys down the street, who will help me plant this wheat? Not I, said the dog and the cat. Not I, said the mouse and the rat. I will then, said the little red hen, and she did. The sun shone bright, the rain it blew, the grain of wheat it grew and grew. It began to sprout, headed out, till it was ripe enough. Said, who will help me harvest this stuff? Not I, said the dog and the cat. Not I, said the mouse and the rat. I will then, said the little red hen, and she did. She lugged it to the miller to grind her flour, 'cause the others would offer her no manpower, and at baking time they all declined to help her with the job. They were a doggone no good mom. Why not I, said the dog and the cat. Not I, said the mouse and the rat. I will then, said the little red hen, and she did. The bread looked good and smelled so fine, the gang came running and fell in line. We'll do our part with all our heart to help you eat this chow. She said, I do not need you now. I planted and hoed this grain of wheat. Them that works not shall not eat. That's my credo, the little bird said, and that's why they called her Red.
That concludes the first episode of this four-part series on women's labor history in Quebec and Canada. Thanks to Dr. Lillian Robinson, principal of the Simone de Beauvoir Institute, and CKUT's own Bianca Allard. Stay tuned for future episodes in this series of the Long-Term Memory Radio Project. You'll hear the voices of Maria Peluso and Micheline Dumont, one of the first scholars to take up Quebec women's history, coming up on the next episode of Women's Labor History in Quebec and Canada, right here on CKUT 90.3 FM every Wednesday from 5 to 6 p.m.
She never was afraid of the goons and the ginks and the company finks and the deputy sheriffs that made the raid. She'd go to the union hall when a meeting it was called, and when the company boys came around, she always stood her ground. Oh, you can't scare me, I'm sticking to the union, I'm sticking to the union, I'm sticking to the union.
Hey, you sing it with us.
Oh, you can't scare me, I'm sticking to the union, I'm sticking with the union till the day I die. This union maid was wise to the tricks of the company spies. She'd never be fooled by a company stool. She'd always organize the guys. She'd always get her way when she asked for better pay. She'd show her card to the National Guard, and this is what she'd say. Oh, you can't scare me, I'm sticking with the union, I'm sticking with the union, I'm sticking with the union. Oh, you can't scare me, I'm sticking with the union, I'm sticking with the union till the day I die.
Oh, one more time.
Oh, you can't scare me, I'm sticking with the union, I'm sticking with the union, I'm sticking with the union. Oh, you can't scare me, I'm sticking with the union, I'm sticking with the union.
In 1999, Quebec nurses went on strike, but after 22 days, their action was declared illegal. 10 years before, women faced even worse legal maneuvering, when striking nurses lost 1 year of seniority for every day of the illegal strike. Just last fall, 80,000 teachers throughout Quebec walked out, and again, essential services laws were cited and teachers forced back to work.
In North America, the Industrial Revolution came through women workers.
Over the next 4 weeks, we'll take up these issues here on CKUT's Long-Term Memory Radio Project, Women's Labor History in Quebec and Canada, every Wednesday from 5 to 6 p.m., concluding on May Day.
Women have always been essential to the labor movement. The first unions that were formed by male-skilled workers who weren't admitting those women.
Hearts starve as well as bodies.